Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was posted to the Associated Press online service on July 10th. It's written by John Moritz, and it's titled, When Are Amtrak's New Trains Due to Arrive in Connecticut? Along with plans to spend billions of dollars upgrading Connecticut's ancient rail infrastructure, officials in both Hartford and Washington, D.C. have promised sleeker, speedier trains to carry riders in and outside of the state of Connecticut. In 2022, the Connecticut Department of Transportation rolled out newer all-electric M8 transets on the Shoreline East service joining Metro North's New Haven line, which began using the same train a decade earlier. Other rail operators, including Amtrak, continue to operate much older fleets that are scheduled for retirement in the coming years. The Northeast Corridor, which runs from Washington, D.C. to Boston, is the nation's busiest intercity passenger rail route, serving more than 12 million passengers last year. Its Acela service was also the only operating high-speed route in the country until Florida's privately owned Brightline began running trains up to 125 miles per hour in September. Originally scheduled to enter service in 2021, Amtrak's planned replacement for its aging Acela fleet has been beset by delays and cost overruns that so far have prevented riders from experiencing the government's $2.45 billion investment. A spokesman for Amtrak, Jason Abrams, said in an email this week that the new units are on presently track for a public launch in late 2024, based on the latest information from the train's manufacturer, Alstom. While Alstom is based in France, the 28 Acela train sets are being assembled at the company's plant in Hornell, New York, and tested in Colorado. The new trains top out at speeds of 160 miles per hour, about 10 miles per hour faster than the current fleet of Acela Express trains that debuted in the late 1990s. It's unlikely, however, that even the newer trains will reach their maximum speeds while making the trek across Connecticut, where congestion along commuter rail lines, aging infrastructure, and winding routes along the shoreline force Acela to operate at sharply reduced speeds. In addition to speed, the new trains will be able to hold about one quarter more passengers and include features such as outlets, USB ports, and complementary Wi-Fi. The Northeast Regional, Amtrak's slower and cheaper alternative to the high-speed Acela service, has relied on the railroad's hallmark Amfleet trains dating back as far as the 1970s. Those trains are due to be replaced starting in 2026 with Amtrak's new Aerofleet, which travels at faster speeds, again, likely to be limited by speed restrictions throughout Connecticut, and feature more modern amenities such as touchless restroom controls, panoramic windows. Like the new Acela models, cars will also be equipped with outlets, USB, and Wi-Fi. The new IRO trains are currently in the design phase and under contract to be built by Siemens from California. In addition to the Northeast Regional, Abrams said that the IRO trains will operate along the Vermonter route and Amtrak's daily service between New Haven and Springfield, Mass. The Connecticut Department of Transportation plans to roll out these Alstom coach cars on the Hartford and New Haven branch lines beginning in 2026. Like Amtrak, Connecticut DOT is partnering with Alstom to replace the state's aging fleet of coaches carrying passengers on the Hartford line, which began service in 2018. The $315 million contract announced by Governor Ned Lamont last year is expected to deliver 60 custom-built coaches starting in 2026. Those trains will replace a fleet of 1990s-era coaches that were previously used by Shoreline East and before that, commuter rail services in Virginia. The new coaches will feature a 2x2 seating configuration along with luggage racks, panoramic windows, and a bicycle storage area. Unlike the current Hartford Line trains, they will also sport Wi-Fi. In addition to the Hartford line, the new trains will also see use on several branches of the New Haven line. To power its coaches along non-electrified portions of Metro North branch lines, Connecticut is also purchasing six Newell dual-mode locomotives from Siemens to be delivered through 2027. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on July 10th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, Man Used Connecticut Addresses to Scam Elderly Victims. A New York man who helped defraud elderly victims out of hundreds of thousands of dollars while sending money to co-conspirators in the Dominican Republic was sentenced to a year in federal prison. Edward Rosario Canella, 48, of the Bronx, New York, was sentenced this week by U.S. District Judge Sarala Nagala in Hartford to 12 months and one day in prison, to be followed by 3 years of supervised release for his role in a grandparent scam, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Rosario pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit mail fraud and wire fraud on November 17, 2022. Court records show that Rosario participated in a grandparent scam, a scheme in which fraudsters who often live outside of the U.S. contact elderly victims in the U.S. by phone, impersonating the victim's grandchild in distress, and induce the victim to send money purportedly to help the grandchild. Rosario reportedly served as a money mule in the scam that victimized multiple people who lived outside of Connecticut, according to court records. For a fee, Rosario picked up money packages victims mailed to addresses in Connecticut and elsewhere and helped to send the money to his co-conspirators in the Dominican Republic. Rosario, who is free on bond, is required to report to prison on September 16th. Nagalia also ordered Rosario to pay a restitution of $650,000, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on July 10th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, Former Connecticut Counselor Defrauded Medicaid for $600,000. A former Connecticut counselor was sentenced to home confinement and probation on Tuesday after previously pleading guilty to submitting over $600,000 in fraudulent Medicaid claims. Jeff Slocums, 56, of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, was sentenced by U.S. District Judge Stephen Underhill in Bridgeport to 3 years of probation, with the first 12 months served in home confinement under electron monitoring, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. In addition to the sentence, Slocum was ordered to pay $695,000 in restitution to Medicaid. Slocum pleaded guilty on August 16, 2023, to one count of health care fraud and one count of violating the federal anti-kickback statute. Court records show that from 2017 to 2022, Slocum, a former East Lyme resident, was a licensed professional counselor with an office in New London. In 2020, the Connecticut Medicaid program told Slocum it planned to audit him for certain claims for psychotherapy services that he billed to Medicaid between March 18th and February 20th. As part of its audit, Medicaid requested patient records for approximately 100 individual psychotherapy services that Slocum had billed to Medicaid. In March 2021, Medicaid notified Slocum that the audit reportedly determined that he had received over $225,000 in payments for services that he had not documented, according to the court records. Medicaid told Slocum it would begin collecting the overpayments in installments from future payments Medicaid would make to him, according to the court records. Once Slocum learned the results of the audit, that he would have to pay the money back to Medicaid, he began submitting fraudulent claims to Medicaid for psychotherapy services that he never provided. All of the claims Slocum fraudulently submitted to Medicaid stated that he personally provided services, according to court records. In addition, Slocum reportedly engaged in a scheme to pay kickbacks to his Medicaid patients by enticing them to receive psychotherapy services from him. Slocum paid these kickbacks to patients in the form of cash payments, money orders, and Walmart and Visa gift cards. The investigation was conducted by the Office of the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, with the assistance of the Connecticut Department of Social Services. People who may suspect health care fraud are asked to report it by calling 1-800-HHS-TIPS, T-I-P-S. Our next article was published in the Meriden Record Journal on July 10th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, New Haven Study Examines Why Children Experience Less Severe COVID-19 Infections. Children were better equipped to fight off the COVID-19 in the early days of the pandemic, according to a study released by Yale University. The new study found that children have stronger general immune defenses in their noses because they frequently get sick with respiratory viruses and disease-causing bacteria, regardless of whether they show symptoms, said Dr. Ellen Foxman, Associate Professor of Laboratory Medicine and Immunobiology at Yale School of Medicine. Foxman said the frequent activation of the immune system helps build more robust general antiviral defenses, which may help prevent them from experiencing severe infections when exposed to a new virus. When there's a new emerging virus like COVID, neither adults nor kids' immune systems remember that virus because it's new. What is revealed is that the kids' constant activation by exposure to new things sort of prepares the kids to deal with new viruses better. Foxman said adults rely primarily on an adaptive immune response built through time, exposure, and vaccines. This pattern helps develop the needed antibodies to fight specific viruses. Meanwhile, children are being exposed to many diseases for the first time, so their bodies rely on the natural general antiviral defenses instead, known as the innate immune system. She said a number of studies already found children had a stronger immunity in the nose to new viruses, but Yale's study found out why it was as activated as it was. Researchers tested more than 600 nasal swabs from COVID-19 tests given to pediatric patients 22 years and younger during the summer of 2021, a period of relatively low pediatric infections. Swabs were also collected in January 2022 during the Omicron surge, which has seen the highest infection rates among children. The swabs were tested for 16 respiratory viruses, including COVID-19 and three types of disease-causing bacteria. Foxman said they found that children had many viruses and bacteria in their noses, activating their innate immune system regardless of whether or not they were showing symptoms at the time. An estimated 44.3% of all samples tested positive for viruses, pathobionts, or both in the summer of 2021. A pathobiont is a type of bacteria that can cause disease. Similarly, in January 2022, 53% of all samples tested positive. The cold was the most common illness in 2021, while COVID-19 was more prevalent in the 2022 swabs. Although Yale researchers tested swabs from a wide range of pediatric patients, Foxman said the most viral and bacterial infections were found among children under the age 5. In the summer of 2021, about 22% of the samples from all asymptomatic children tested positive for viruses or bacteria, but among children under 5 years old, the proportion was 32%. About 6 months later, 35% of the samples from asymptomatic children tested positive overall, but 60% tested positive among the young cohort. Researchers also swabbed the noses of 21-year-olds during wellness appointments, and again about 2 weeks later to see how incidental viral infections affect immune defenses over time. They found that most children had viruses detected in one sample but not the other. The study concluded that children experience mild infections frequently, activating and developing strong innate defenses to their nose at higher rate. Foxman said she was surprised by the sheer prevalence of viruses on the swabs, despite none of the patients coming in for a sick visit. She said it was striking to see how often children were getting respiratory viruses that activated antiviral defenses in the nose without causing symptoms. She said this showed how people's bodies can adapt to fight off early life infections without showing symptoms and may help to promote the immune system's function. It's a sort of fluctuating state that's going to go up and down in parallel with acquisition and clearance of viruses. All the time, kids are getting and clearing these mild viral infections that are affecting this immune system in their respiratory tract, in their nose, in their lungs. The significance of that was even when you might not be aware that your child has a viral infection. They might have one, and there might be some benefits to it. Foxman said the presence of viruses in the youngest of patients versus older ones shows how the immune system changes over time and exposure. These changes can help determine why certain age groups are more susceptible to certain infections. However, she said more studies are needed to better understand how the immune system develops from childhood to adolescence and adulthood. Although children have more active innate immune defenses in their noses, Foxman said parents should still consider pediatric vaccines for respiratory illnesses with known adverse impacts on children's health, such as COVID-19, influenza, and RSV. She said further studying the relationships between child's ongoing natural immune system and vaccines can help improve the effectiveness of vaccines. Young children, their state of innate immune activation is fluctuating and going up and down. What are the implications of that for the susceptibility to other infections and to understand how well vaccines work? Foxman said kids get the lot of vaccines in their very few years of life, and some of them are really effective. Can we take the lesson learned from this paper, for example, make flu vaccines more effective in the future? Our next article was posted to the Town of New Milford online service on July 10th. It's written by Caitlin Lyle, and it's titled, New Milford Approves $5 Million Plan to Expand Fire Company Station. The Water Witch Hose Company No. 2 got the green light to move forward with its plan to expand and renovate the company's substation on Lanesville Road. This project is long overdue and is finally coming to fruition, New Milford resident Tom Pillen said at a special town meeting. We've been very fortunate as a community to have the volunteer firefighters. We're grateful to them, and whatever we can do to make it better, to make New Milford the greatest town there is to support this project and bonding to get the project up and running. The public and members of the town council unanimously approved a resolution on Monday to appropriate $5 million for the expansion and renovation of the Lanesville Fire Substation. The project involves renovating approximately 5,500 square feet of the existing fire substation and expanding it by 8,200 square feet. The appropriation may be spent on surveying, design, construction, equipment, demolition, construction, management buy, and consulting and engineering fees, among other costs, according to the resolution. Built in 1980, the town-owned fire substation is located at 2 Lanesville Road off Route 202, and next to the auto repair shop J&J Motors at 4 Lanesville Road. The facility is used as the Water Witch Hose Company's second station, along with the fire station at 8 Prospect Hill Road. The substation is also used by the town's other fire departments when responding to mutual aid and while on standby, according to Sean Delaney, second assistant chief of the Water Witch Hose Company No. 2. Plans to expand the substation have been on the works for 11 years, said firefighter Mark Haber. We really gave it a swift kick in the butt in the last 18 to 24 months. Delaney said the substation's expansion started when the fire company trustees had the foresight to understand the development of this community. With New Milford's population rising, traffic on Route 7 increasing, and 450 new housing developments, the fire company anticipated responding to more calls and spending more time on the road because of the town growth. The substation's expansion will increase the fire company's capabilities and pre-planning strategies during the large-scale incidents and weather events, in addition to creating more space, said Haber. The existing substation holds 2 fire trucks, 2 boats, 2 trailers, 1 pickup truck, and 1 utility truck. The expanded substation will be able to house 2 or 3 more pieces of equipment, depending on their size, as well as the company's ladder truck. The project calls for installing 2 full handicap accessible bathrooms with shower facilities, installing a new kitchen with a dining area, creating an office for the company's officers, creating a training room, installing a new furnace, and upgrading the substation's heating and cooling systems and lighting. The company anticipates completing the project in 2 phases, with the first phase focused on designing the building plans and drawings, completing site work and underground utilities, and installing the pre-engineered building. He said the second phase will focus on the full renovation of the existing substation building and paving the reconfigured drawing from above. The company hopes to put the project out to bid in August and have the site work ready and materials delivered by next May. Phase 2 of the project would go out to bid in August 2025, with the company choosing a contractor by November 25, followed by 9 months of renovation work. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on July 9th. It's written by Blaine Callahan, and it's titled, Labyrinth Brewing Company in Manchester Closing After 6 Years. Labyrinth Brewing Company announced the business will be closing its doors for good on Sunday, July 21st, according to a Facebook post. We had a hell of a run over the last 6 years, but we've reached the end of the journey, the brewery posted. Labyrinth will be closing outdoors on Saturday, July 21st. The Manchester Brewery has been around for 6 years and has been a mainstay in the state's craft beer scene, with brews like New England IPA, Turbo Love Juice, and Sour Batch Series. They boasted a cozy, inviting brewery with Dungeons & Dragons meets heavy metal references abound in their March and labels. There are many factors that no single reason that lead up to this choice, and the short version is the numbers don't work. This was not a decision we made lightly, but it is one we have made nevertheless. Labyrinth went on to thank its staff and customers. We are humbled to have had the chance to share our dream and some beers with you all. While this is the end for Labyrinth, it's also the beginning of whatever comes next. Our next article was posted to the Town of West Hartford online service on July 9th. It's written by Paul Schott, and it's titled, Santander Bank to Close a Branch in West Hartford. The Santander Bank branch, which has 15 branches in Connecticut, plans to close one of those established at the end of summer. The Santander branch at 1040 Boulevard in the Boulevard Shops Center in West Hartford is scheduled to close on September 19th, according to company officials. It will be Santander's 11th branch shutdown in Connecticut since 2019. A Santander spokesperson confirmed that the scheduled date of the closing at 1040 Boulevard and also noted that an ATM would continue to operate at that location after she comes and visits. After the closing, Santander will have 14 branches remaining in Connecticut. It will have two branches in West Hartford at 1010 Farmington Avenue and 342 North Main Street, as well as branches in Avon, Bristol, East Hartford, Enfield, Glastonbury, Hartford, New Haven, Newington, South Windsor, and Southington, and Waterbury. As of June 20th, 2023, Santander had about $1.8 billion in deposits in Connecticut, ranking number 13 among banks operating in the state, according to data from the Federal Deposit Insurance Company. At the same time, finances appeared to be stable at Santander's giant and parent company, which is headquartered at a suburb in Madrid, Spain. For the first quarter of 2024, the company reported a profit of about $3.1 billion, up 11% from the same period in 2023. Since the start of 2019, more than 200 bank branches have closed across Connecticut, a trend driven by the ongoing increase in digital banking. Among other branch closings this year, Bank of America shut down a branch in Greenwich on March 19th and a branch in Stamford on April 30th. It plans to close a branch each in Hartford and Norwalk on August 20th. Bank of America ranks number one for in-state deposits. Wells Fargo, number six for in-state deposits, closes a branch east in Bethel and New Haven on May 15th and plans to shut down a branch in Meriden on August 7th. TD Bank, number five for in-state deposits, plans to close a branch each in Fairfield and Wallington on September 20th. Citizens Bank, number nine in estate deposits, closes a bank in East Lyme on January 24th. First County Bank, number 16 in estate deposits, closed a branch in Stamford on March 1st. Patriot Bank, number 25 for estate deposits, shuttered its branches in Orange on April 25th. Berkshire Bank, number 18 for in-state deposits, closed three branches at the end of June in Hartford, Killingly, and Tallinn. Our next article was posted to the Town of Fairfield online service on July 9th. It's written by Gerard Wardwell, and it's titled, Fairfield Sacred Heart Prepares to Open Two New Residence Halls. The residential core of Sacred Heart University's campus has grown by two buildings. Sacred Heart will open two new resident halls that together contain 480 beds next month in Pioneer Village, a complex of now eight residential buildings, and a dining facility at the former Jewish Senior Services site, which the university bought in 2016. Officials said the latest residence halls will accommodate the university's continued rise in enrollment. It's a testament to what we've built, said Mark Izzo, the Vice President of Construction and Facilities Management, of the increasing number of students at Sacred Heart University. It's drawn students in Obviously, our academics speak for themselves, but again, it's a safe campus, and with all the new buildings, parents just feel comfortable sending their kids here. The construction of the two new buildings, Catherine of Siena and Michael McGivney Halls, was a $72 million effort that moved forward in 2022 and wrapped up in March. The final product is a pair of identical three-story resident halls off Jefferson Street, matching the tan brick coating that's become the signature aesthetic among many of the university's residential buildings. This is like the growing trend of what college kids want, Izzo said. So I think we're ahead of the curve on a lot of our buildings since everybody's pretty new. He said the university outfitted Siena and McGivney Halls with laundry and a lounge area on every floor, glass-enclosed study rooms, and a 200-space parking garage. A crossover bridge with a lounge area and a small kitchen links the two buildings, which Izzo says spans 132,000 square feet. He expects each building to be filled when school year starts, and the students moving in next month will be the first to live there, likely followed by some of the summer camps the university hosts during the summer. Siena McGivney Halls are filled with two-bedroom suites designed to house four students, each with their own desk and chair. The suites also include a mini fridge, bathroom, air conditioning, and heating. The new buildings in their design blend into the network of resident halls that fill Pioneer Village, which has over 1,300 students, mostly freshmen and sophomores, that they call home. Izzo said the university is in the middle of a multiple three-year interior and exterior renovation projects at Thomas Merton, Elizabeth Ann Seton, and Angelo Roncalli Hall. None are part of Pioneer Village, but Izzo said Sacred Heart wants to equip them with the same architecture and amenities as a campus-wide standard for the university's resident halls. He said that architectural style is known as block and plank, featuring sheetrock interiors and a lifespan that can last 100 years. It's like the cozy living of a home, Izzo said. Izzo said Fairfield Town officials allowed Sacred Heart to build up to 500,000 additional square feet a few years ago after approving an increase in the floor area ratio, which measures the size of a building in comparison to its lot. Construction on campus continues to churn beyond SHU's residence halls between a renovation at the Pitt Center, an upcoming expansion of the university's health science building, and likely more improvements to come at Notre Dame High School, which Sacred Heart agreed to buy earlier this year. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on July 9th. It's written by a variety of staff and is titled, Big Lots Announces Store Closings and Pullback in Consumer Spending. Big Lots, which has 16 stores in Connecticut, has announced in an SEC filing that it plans to close between 35 to 40 stores in 2024. The SEC filing reported existence of substantial doubt regarding our ability to continue as a growing concern. The company has previously said it missed its sales goals due largely to a continued pullback in consumer spending by our core members. The Ohio-based discount chain said in its June quarter one results that Big Lots had reported a net loss of $205 million or $7 per share for the first quarter of fiscal 2024 that ended on May 4th, 2024. The result includes a net after-tax loss of $73 million or $2.50 per diluted share associated with impairment charges fees related to Project Springboard and distribution center closure costs. Excluding this loss, the adjusted net loss in the first quarter of 2024 was $132.3 million or $4.50 per diluted share. The adjusted net loss for the first quarter of fiscal 2023 was $98.7 million or $3.40 per diluted share, the company said in a June report. A request for comment was sent to the corporation, but no response came back. Bruce Thorne, president and CEO of Big Lots, said at the time in the June announcement, while we made substantial progress on improving our business operations in quarter number one, we missed our sales goals due largely to a continued pullback in consumer spending by our core customers, particularly in high-ticket discretionary items. We remain focused on managing through the current economic cycle by controlling the controllables. As we move forward, we're taking aggressive actions to drive positive comp sales growth in the latter part of the year and into 2025, and to maintain year-over-year gross margin rate improvements, all driven by progress on our five key actions. Our operational initiatives to offer a larger assortment of new and exciting extreme bargains, cut costs, and increase productivity exceeded our targets in Q1. This enabled us to improve consumer perceptions about our brand and the value we offer, and to deliver a year-over-year improvement in gross margin and operating expenses, despite significant sales pressure. As a reminder, our five key actions are to own bargains, to communicate unmistakable value, to increase store relevance, and to win customers for life with our omnichannel efforts, and to drive productivity. We still have a lot of work ahead of us, but remain confident that the five key actions are putting us on the right path to turn around our business. The SEC report said, forward-looking statements that we make within and in other reports and releases are not guarantees of future performance, and actual results may differ materially from those discussed in such forward-looking statements as a result of various factors, including but not limited to the current economic and credit conditions, inflation, the cost of goods, our inability to successfully execute strategic initiatives, competitive pressures, economic pressures on our customers, and us, our inability to implement strategic actions and alternatives to improve our performance and liquidity and mitigate the existence of substantial doubt regarding our ability to continue as a growing concern. Our inability to increase cash flow to support our operating activities and fund our obligations and working capital needs is also a concern. The availability of brand name closeout merchandise, trade restrictions, freight costs, the risk associated in the other factors discussed from time to time in our filings with the SEC, according to quarterly reports on Form 10-Q and current reports on Form 8-K. This report should be read in conjunction with such filings, and you should consider all of these risks, uncertainties, and other factors carefully in evaluating forward-looking statements. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on July 9th. It's written by Justin Musinski, and it's titled, A Connecticut Pediatrician is Accused of Slapping a Patient's Buttocks. A Connecticut pediatrician has been accused of inappropriately touching a minor in May while examining a rash the child had, according to a warrant affidavit for his arrest. Dr. Ravi Prakash, 61, allegedly slapped the child's buttocks during an exam on May 2nd in front of the victim's mother, the warrant affidavit authored by a Norwich Police Department detective said. Prakash was arrested on June 28th when he turned himself in on charges of fourth-degree sexual assault and risk of injury to a minor. He posted a $50,000 bond and is expected to face a judge in Norwich Superior Court on Tuesday. According to the warrant affidavit, the mothers brought the child to the victim's pediatrician for a rash around at Prakash Pediatrics on the London Turnpike in New Orange. The mother said the victim was apprehensive about lifting their shirt and showing Prakash the rash, but she assured the child it was okay because he was a doctor. The mother told investigators that Prakash examined the rash on the child's back and allegedly used an open hand to slap the child's buttocks, according to the warrant affidavit. After the appointment, the child told their mother they felt uncomfortable, dirty, and violated from what happened, according to the warrant affidavit. The mother went to Norwich Police Department the same evening and reported the allegations. Prakash agreed to speak with investigators on May 31st and told a detective that he had inadvertently may have contact with the child during the examination. He told police after examining the rash, he instructed the child to sit back down on the exam table, and as he did, he made a dismissed motion with his hand, according to the warrant affidavit. Prakash told police his hand accidentally made contact with the child's buttocks or hips as they stepped up onto a stool to get back on the table. Prakash told investigators he did not think much of the contact and that the child's mother never said anything and even looked or booked a follow-up appointment on her way out. The next day, they told police, the mother showed up at his office and demanded her child's medical records, claiming he was a child molester. Prakash said he called the police because she was causing a disturbance and he needed to see other patients. The mother contacted authorities again on June 6th and asked the detective to listen to a recording that she said she took while she was asking for medical records. In the recording, a man who claimed to be Prakash can allegedly be heard saying, "What's your problem? You saw what I did." The mother then responds, "Yeah, you slapped my butt," according to the warrant affidavit. The individual on the recording then allegedly said, "I was playing," the warrant affidavit said. "Just because I was in the room doesn't give you the right to slap my blank blank," the mother said. The older individual allegedly went on to state that he didn't do anything inappropriate before adding, "When I am familiar with my kids, I just did it as a friendly gesture." When the man asked the mother if she was recording, he allegedly refused to give her child's medical records until she deleted the video, the warrant affidavit said. Our next article was posted to the City of Middletown online service on July 9th. It's written by Cassandra Day, and it's titled, "Middletown Concerned About Wetland Activity." A city agency recently prolonged a cease and desist order it issued in June to a local farmer and owner of 13 acres at 350 Randolph Road following a wetlands dispute. Matt Mitchell, owner of Lovey's Farm, returned to the Middletown Inland Wetlands and Watercourses Agency meeting last week without a wetlands delineation study that commissioners had told him on June 5th he needed before his application would be considered. "In order to make a decision, we need to know where the wetlands are," Joseph Carta, the agency's chairman, told Mitchell at the July meeting. "The only way to know where the wetlands are is to have them delineated. The only way to have them delineated is with a registered soil scientist. You don't have any kind of plan for us to look at." Mitchell said on Monday that he's in the process of finding a soil scientist to do the required work. "Money is another factor," said Mitchell, who was told that the delineation could cost between $3,500 and $10,000, depending on the extent of the job. It comes after the agency already raised concerns over whether he was disturbing the wetlands on property. Mitchell is looking to create a community farm dedicated to regenerative farming practices that would promote long-term sustainability. He named the farm after his four-year-old daughter, Sienna Lovey, and will raise chickens, goats, and honeybees on the land. "It would help maintain the land," Mitchell said. "It would be an eyesore because of overgrown brush when people drive down the road." Mitchell said on Monday that he would eventually like to offer small plots to the community to farm for free or a small fee as part of an incubator program. That idea was born during the pandemic after Mitchell purchased fruits and vegetables at a local store. They were spoiled a day later. Education is also a big component of the plan. Mitchell wants to eventually sponsor youth to apply for $5,000 loans from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to plant their own crops. Farmers need to obtain a number from the USDA in order to receive grants. "Nobody's telling minority farmers to go out and get a farm track number so you can qualify for programs. This will serve as an incubator to assist and help people to do that. If you don't have a farm track number, you're a gardener." In the future, Mitchell would like to teach people about land conservation, pollinator gardens, and other aspects of farming. Lovey's Farm has partnered on the initiative with D's Crafty Bees, Chicks Ahoy, Chicks Ahoy Farm, and Cultivating Justice, a project of the Cato Center for Equity, Health, and Justice. Before Mitchell's ideas can happen, though, he and the city must reach a resolution over the wetlands on the property after the pallets placed there. During the June meeting, Mitchell explained that situation arose after the city received numerous complaints that a large number of wooden pallets were on the portion of the property designated as wetlands. According to the cease and desist order on dated May 24th, City Environmental Planner James Cipperly issued a verbal warning to stop work after he saw someone carrying what he said were wood chips throughout the woodlands. "Nobody was carrying wood chips to the back of the property," Mitchell told commissioners in June. "It was food." The commission then asked Mitchell to have a wetland soil scientist walk the property and submit the findings prior to the July 3 meeting. In the meantime, officials gave Mitchell permission to feed his animals, but to refrain from all other activity. Agency members visited the farm on June 14th. Commission Chairman Joseph Carta said at the recent meeting that members saw pallets placed in the wetlands across the stream to get to the animals contained in an upper part of the property. "In some spots, there are two layers of pallets because they sunk." Mitchell said the pallets are different sizes and made of untreated wood. Members also questioned the use of the chips at the site and if the birds eat them. Mitchell said the pile attracts insects and a chicken will dig for and eat. He added the pile also turns into compost. It turns into compost, Miller said. They decompose, so it's a cycle. This is not about chickens or goats or farming. When we saw what was all the animals are high on high ground on the far side of the stream, Vice President Ken McClellan said at the meeting, we saw wood and pallets and scrap in a very wet area and what appeared to me to have wetland vegetation streams, and that's what we are concerned about. Mitchell said on Monday that he had hoped to put up greenhouses by now and plant pumpkin seeds for the fall, but it's too late in the season to do so. He also had to hold off on buying more goats that graze and help sustain the land. The matter was continued to August 7th meeting at City Hall at the Coven Drive. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on July 9th. It's written by Mark Zaretsky and it's titled, What Can Connecticut Expect from Supreme Court's Decision on Evicting Homeless? A U.S. Supreme Court decision that found cities have broad power to evict people from encampments and confiscate their properties unlikely to affect life for unhoused people in Connecticut, according to local advocates and government officials. But the June 28th ruling, which affects more than 650,000 people experiencing homelessness, according to the federal government, represents a new low for a government that should be doing everything it can to help people who need it, not criminalize them for being poor or mentally ill. It really gets to me that they're treating homelessness as a crime rather than a condition, said the Reverend Sarah Smith, who has spent 15 years fighting homelessness in Bridgeport. The controversial ruling overturned a California-based appeals court previous ruling in a case involving Grants Pass, a city of 39,000 in southwest Oregon that has just one homeless shelter. It cleared the way for cities to enforce bans on unhoused people sleeping outside in public places. In the 6-3 decision, which fell along ideological lines, the Supreme Court found that outdoor sleeping bans and confiscating the unhoused people's belongings don't constitute cruel and unusual punishment and therefore don't violate the Eighth Amendment. Cities that remove people from encampments and prosecute them are not punishing them for their status of homelessness, but for their actions, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote for the majority in the 6-3 ruling. A handful of federal judges cannot begin to match the collective wisdom the American people possess in deciding how best to handle a pressing social question like homelessness. Gorsuch wrote that he was joined by fellow conservatives Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Chief Justice John Roberts. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissenting opinion that Grants Pass was punishing people for their homelessness by jailing and fining people for sleeping in public, including their car. Sleep is a biological need, and for some, outside is their only option, she wrote. She was joined by liberal justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. For people with no access to shelter, that punishes them for being homeless, Sotomayor wrote. That is unconscionable and unconstitutional. A number of people have spent years trying to ease homelessness and help those affected in Connecticut cities, including New Haven, Bridgeport, Norwalk, Stamford, and Danbury, find a decision hard to swallow, regardless of what the court said. People have yet to know, just because the Supreme Court said it, that it doesn't make it right and it doesn't make it true, said Smith, senior pastor of the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport. Where is the help in this? Where is the aid to people? Smith said people are unhoused for a variety of reasons, including a mental illness, a medical condition, or other outside circumstances. She said people should help people who are unhoused and lead a campaign to build tiny houses rather than punish those who are homeless and criminalize it. To me, this is dehumanizing. It makes me crazy. It's just flat out unethical and very wrong. New Haven Mayor Justin Elicker doesn't see the Supreme Court decision as changing much about the way people struggle with homelessness are, and they are all treated in New Haven with extra care. It doesn't change anything for us here, Elicker said. We continue to have the same approach of trying to work with people when they are in encampments to try to find options for them. We have a very compassionate approach. Steve Worland, executive director of the Downtown Evening Soup Kitchen in New Haven, said he takes Elicker on his word. He said things aren't as bad in New Haven as other parts of the country in house law enforcement treats people who are unhoused, but there's room for improvement. The ruling is incredibly depressing about what we're seeing in the state of compassion throughout our country. This should be an opportunity for us to say we're going to do better. Bridgeport Deputy Chief Administrative Officer David Rees agreed with Eckler, saying he doesn't expect the ruling to change policies and practice in Connecticut's largest city. We don't arrest homeless individuals. What we do is we meet them where they are. We're not looking to arrest people. We're looking to help them. We connect them with services. They may need help, and they don't know where to go. But Jen Paradise, Executive Director of Milford's Bethel Center, which runs that city's only shelter, said she's not convinced the Supreme Court ruling won't change anything in Connecticut. We can't be naive to the fact that we have communities in Connecticut that this reflects and supports what their thoughts are, said Paradise, also the immediate past president of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. She said municipalities don't have the resources to ease homelessness, and a cheaper option is criminalization. She said the state is in a homeless crisis with more people facing homelessness than at any other time in at least the last decade. Mark Colville, who was the only person arrested when New Haven cleared the tent city encampment off El Tigre Grasso Boulevard on the West River in 2023, was infuriated with the decision. The courts have been weaponized, said Colville, a member and organizer of New Haven's Unhoused Activist Community Team, or UACT, who opened the back door of his Amistad Catholic Worker House to people who might otherwise be unhoused. Colville doubted officials' comments, though, that the decision likely wouldn't change things in Connecticut, countering it opened up what officials could do regarding removing encampments. He added he planned to fight it. Don't tell me that when a government official has that power, they won't use it, Colville said. They most certainly will use it. State Representative David McKell, Democrat from Stanford, who often speaks as an advocate for unhoused residents, said it's his duty as an elected representative to protect people who live in the district, regardless of their status. He too said the Supreme Court was politically charged and made a decision that disregarded the humanity of our homeless. We can't throw away the bag of stuff from someone who is homeless. They could be all their belongings, Michael said, adding that it would be hard to replace if they lose that one piece of ID in their stuff. They would have nothing. Ari Rosenberg, executive director of the Danbury-based Association of Religious Communities, echoed Michael's stance on the morality of the decision. The Supreme Court has lost its moral compass. They have no empathy for the individuals we serve. They lost touch with the spiritual value of providing the basic needs of food, shelter, and health care to people less fortunate than ourselves. If someone has no home and the community does not provide for shelter, then they can't just harass the person and they charge them money until they leave. Is that what Jesus would do? Added Rosenberg, who also heads Danbury's homeless services at two shelters. I think not. Bridgeport Councilman Jorge Cruz, Democrat from the 131st District, said the Supreme Court ruling should not impose this on people already suffering with homelessness. You need to treat people like humans, not like animals. It's just a shame. It's unfair. This is not an American standard. Cruz has worked with Bridgeport's homeless outreach team and currently works with the State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. We have a serious shortage here, and it breaks my heart when I go by the bus station or the railroad station and see people on the benches, he said, adding, the Supreme Court's decision will not help. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on July 9th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, Connecticut Program Camp Sparkler launches with virtual weekly stories and activities. Sparkler Learning announced a team up with the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood and United Way of Connecticut's 211 Child Development to bring the start of Camp Sparkler, a free 8-week virtual summer camp for families and children 5 years of age and under. Starting Monday, July 8th, families will find a weekly lineup of stories and activities on their Sparkler app per a statement. Each week, families will find a story told by someone from the culture where it originated, as well as a lineup of off-screen play-based learning activities for parents and children to play together, according to a recent statement. The top 100 families to participate the most throughout the Camp Sparkler will win Target gift cards as well. Welcome to opening day of Camp Sparkler 2024, said OEC Commissioner Beth Bai. I think this is going to be a tremendous time of growth and learning for your young children across our state this summer. The launch took place on July 8th, where Milford Public Schools shared this week's story, The Legend of the Coqui from Puerto Rico, according to the organization. We are excited to offer this free virtual summer learning opportunity to children and families across Connecticut, said Dana Stewart, Director of Education at Sparkler. We can't wait to take an imaginary trip around the world with Connecticut families this summer, all thanks to the power of stories. So here's the breakdown of weekly topics. The first week, The Legend of Coqui, Puerto Rico. The second week, The Magpie's Nest from the United Kingdom. Week three, The Flying Africans from the USA. Week four, The Fox and the Mole, Peru. Week five, Goals Encounter with Tiger, West Africa. Week six, The Hill of Seven Colors, Argentina. Week seven, The Businessman and the Donkey, Ethiopia. And week eight, Good Little Bunnies from China. Our families are excited to get out their imaginary passports and travel around the world this summer with Camp Sparkler. We cannot wait to hear all the wonderful stories being shared and to engage in the fun play card activities, said Therese McGuire, the supervisor of the early childhood education for Milford Public Schools. In order to participate, families need to download the Sparkler app from the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store and register with a local Connecticut program code or the access code CT. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on July 9th. It's written by Stephen Underwood, and it's titled, Residents in a Suburban Connecticut Town Say Rats Have Gotten Out of Control. Emily Salvador said she's fed up with the rats that she sees nearly daily on her property. Salvador, who moved to the Elmwood section of West Hartford in 2015, said that she never had an issue with rodents until this January, when things started getting out of control. But now the mom of two young children said she's fed up and looking to take the town in action. In the winter, we noticed holes along our driveway, and then my husband was out one night walking a dog, and he said they were chased by what looked like a big rat. My first thought was, yeah, okay. So I put out a trap and caught one the next day. Salvatore said that began a months-long saga of trapping, killing, and finding dead rats around her property. Salvador and her husband, who is a landscaper, said they keep their yard well-maintained and are careful not to attract the rodents, but despite this, the rats keep coming after months of pest control measures and several visits from an expensive exterminator. I was trapping and killing like six per week at one point, Salvador said. They stopped for a while and then they came back again. I have an exterminator that has come multiple times, but we still have a problem. It's really gotten out of control and I have little kids to worry about. But Salvador, who was one of numerous residents on a recent Facebook thread, complained of rats in the town and said despite calling the town municipal times, she has refused to let any officials on her property. I keep getting transferred or hung up during the transfer when I call the town. I called the health district and the woman on the phone said they would come out and inspect the property but would ticket me if they find violations for tall grass and trash. But I have a very well-maintained lawn, and that kind of got me mad, so I told them to stay off my property. Jocelyn Santiago, who also lives right off the Britton Avenue, said despite putting out several traps and having to dig up her garden, the rats are still on her property. I've lived here about a year now. In November, I started noticing rats, and they've been around ever since. They have been destroying my garden. I catch them running in and out of my yard. It's gross and very discouraging because of the work I put into the garden. I also took my bird feeders down immediately because I saw my cat looking out the window one day and there was literally a bunch of rats on the feeder. I've written to the town, but I don't think they believe it's an issue. It's comical to me they see others think this is an issue exclusive to the area. Sometimes people think the Elmwood section of town is not really West Hartford, which is disheartening. Maybe the issue isn't being taken as seriously for that reason, or there's a stigma. I'm now encouraging folks to go to town council and speak during public comments. Isolated incidents or a bigger problem? The West Hartford Bloomfield Health District said that they see an uptick in rat and other rodents every spring and summer as more people gather outside. The Nora rat, the most common species in the state, often breeds in the warmer months and leading to increases in sightings, according to the State Department of Environmental Protection. While still active in the winter months, the species is more dormant, leading to fewer sightings. It's not in just one particular area of the town. We get calls in different places, said Amy Cross, health director. We go through waves of sightings. All it takes is a couple bags of trash in a dumpster or food left out, and we see a spike in calls. It then starts to drop off in the fall every year. Krause, who was appointed as director in 2020 said so far this year, she hasn't seen any unusual spikes in rat sightings outside of the normal seasonal uptick, but she confirmed her office has received a number of calls for rat sightings this spring around town. If we do see things in certain areas, we have a complaint and investigate it. We have staff that go out and conduct a survey of the area and reach out to neighbors. We also provide information on proper property maintenance. West Hartford Town Manager Rick Ledwith said the town takes the issue seriously, but if a homeowner refuses to let health district staff onto their property, there's little the town can do. Ledwith said that if a property is found to be in violation of town code, the property owners can be fined daily until they are compliant. Like every town does, we have rodents we have to deal with. We have had a person calling a number of times, but they refuse to let us on their property or tell us where to go to come out and investigate, so we've not been able to do that. Last year, we had an issue on Boulanger Street, but have not had any since then. Ledwith said that the health district found a household last summer that had not been sealing their trash and leaving open bags beside their trash bins. He said the homeowner was fined for breaking the town's health code and the rodent infestation dissipated. This year, we haven't had any specific complaints on Boulanger Street. There are a couple of restaurants at the end of the street, but we found the restaurants are very compliant with their mitigation efforts, but that's how we deal with it. We get a tip and the health district gets involved. They get their team out there and we address it. Some residents are blaming new construction and an increase in development for the uptick in rat sightings around town. Really, since the pandemic, we have seen a trend in more rodents around the area, said Michael Sarnese, vice president of Richland Pest and Bee Control. West Hartford is really exploding in population. I grew up in the town and Blueback Square wasn't even there when I was in high school. So, as West Hartford grows, it gives more opportunities for rodents like rats to find food. The pesky rodent can adjust to their surroundings rather quickly and usually live close to where people live, as this creates easy access to food. Even though rats prefer to live near restaurants and homes, rats will build nests in abandoned buildings too. So it would make perfect sense for the rodent to find the Yukon West building to be an attractive option if they can find a way inside. Even a well-landscaped house with plenty of trees and bushes is an ideal place for rodents. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about the articles read today or other programs here at CHRIS, please call the CHRIS Sister line at 860-727-9579. This is Pete. So long till next time.